TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Where are the people in the nuclear age? On December 2nd, 2017, the University of Chicago celebrated the 75th anniversary of the first nuclear chain reaction that led to the building of the atomic bombs and the nuclear power industry. The physicist Leo Szilard said at the time that by his and Enrico Fermi's invention, universal death had come into the world. Today, critics of the 2017 anniversary say that the lectures and events were biased in favor of nuclear weapons and nuclear power, and even insulting to radiation victims as they culminated in fireworks in the shape of a mushroom cloud. The Nuclear Energy Information Service, NEIS, called attention to the plight of people who suffer the consequences of radiation. Dave Kraft of NEIS introduces the first speaker, Fairwinds Energy Education's Arne Gundersen.
We attended a birthday party yesterday at the University of Chicago, which was appalling. You certainly want to celebrate and acknowledge a tremendous scientific achievement, but at least you should have the integrity to do it truthfully. And some of the programs we saw yesterday were so bereft of intellectual honesty as to really question the validity of the University of Chicago as an educational institution. Today, you're going to hear the other pieces that got left out yesterday. We keep hearing about RADs and REMs and millions of bags of cubic feet of radioactive material and tuna fish. And the simple question is, in all of that, where are the people? Where is the discussion of the effects on people for the nuclear age? And today, I'm really pleased to be able to present two people to you who have been asking this question and fighting to get people on the agenda for decades. I've known Arne Gundersen for quite a while now. He is the chief engineer at Fairwinds Energy Education. He will be the first speaker. He is an expert nuclear witness, trained nuclear engineer, former nuclear energy utility vice president. This is someone who has observed things for 40 years. He is coming from data. So, welcome, my friend Arne Gundersen.
So thanks everybody for coming. In 2011, we're almost 7 years into it now, people were forced to evacuate their communities, their cities, their ancestral homeland because of the triple meltdowns at the Fukushima Daiichi reactors. And the question really should be, as Dave said in the introductory remarks, where are they now? Who watches out for them now? Who speaks for them now and who speaks to them now? Who helps them build new lives and move on from this event? And I think my conclusion is that no one does. Just this week, Japan Today had a headline, and it said, "Risky stalemate as science battles human fears at Fukushima." And I think that really encapsulates what I wanted to talk about today. The nuclear industry has, and the Japanese government, have co-opted the media. And what we've got here is a typical example in that one headline. It's as if science knows what's right, and then we have this irrational human fear that people just don't understand. You know, if they really knew the science, they would come back to their homes and play baseball on the fields and have a good time in life. Well, I'm a scientist, and I've been all my life, and I'm afraid. And when I saw this headline, I just said, shame on Japan Today for publishing a headline like that. Really, the topic of today is using the internet to speak truth to power. And by power, we mean the worldwide nuclear industry, the national nuclear industries, and banks and politicians as well. When we speak truth to power, it's a group of citizens using the internet effectively to butt heads against the powers that be. And this is something that didn't exist with Chernobyl and didn't exist with Three Mile Island. For me, this is really about giving people a voice in the international conversation about nuclear power. And on the opposite side of the argument are governments, the nuclear industry, and unfortunately, a co-opted media. The first trip was in February of 2012. It was for a week. And I just came back from another trip that ended in September, which was for 2 weeks, of gathering data and teaching scientists and citizens there how to collect data on their own. Before I get into my trip, so I want to talk about the background of the institutions in Japan that we were facing when we went over there. The first is Prime Minister Abe had passed a law called the State Secrets Act, and it can be interpreted as allowing the government to imprison journalists, teachers, scientists, and others when they discuss Fukushima in a light that's unflattering to the government. It's a very loosely written law that terrifies journalists and other people. In fact, when I was over there recently, they urged me to get my samples done before I started my public speaking because they were afraid I might get thrown out of the country. 6 months after the nuclear disaster, Prime Minister Abe declared that Fukushima was in something called cold shutdown. Now, in nuke speak, the jargon that I grew up with, that means that the plant is cool and you can begin to refuel it. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. It's sort of like George Bush's comment about mission accomplished. And, you know, 15 years later, we're still involved. The other piece of the puzzle is the relationship between the regulator and the government and the banks and Tokyo Electric. They're sort of those four pieces of the puzzle. I'll be using TEPCO frequently, but it stands for Tokyo Electric. It was the largest nuclear utility and one of the largest utilities in the world. It turns out that 3 weeks after the disaster, the government, its regulators, the equivalent of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and TEPCO and their banks cut a deal. And the deal basically assured that TEPCO would survive. So while they should have been focused on the survival of its citizens, they basically said their top priority was the survival of Tokyo Electric. In addition, about a year after that, the Japanese government successfully lobbied to get the Summer Olympics into Japan in 2020. This is really a blatant attempt to replace a public fear of radiation contaminating northern Japan with a feel-good event like the Olympics. And the last piece of this background that I went into was the censoring of doctors. I've spoken to many doctors, and they're all under enormous pressure. When they see situations with people that clearly have a radiation-related illness, they're not allowed to diagnose it as such. They have to say it's stress. It's putting the burden of the illness back on the person who is in fact really ill. And it's also destroying the epidemiological record for scientists like me. That's the background against which my trips have been made. The first trip was sponsored by Shueisha. Maggie and I co-authored a book with a Japanese author. In English, the title is Fukushima Daiichi, The Truth and the Way Forward. It talks about the cause of the accident, but it also shows the Japanese an alternative approach to the future. Shueisha was our publisher. The very first day that I spoke at the National Press Club, and at the National Press Club, I was the first person to talk about the cost of decontaminating not just the nuclear site, like it's happening at Zion, but in fact the whole state of Fukushima. The state of Fukushima is roughly the size of Connecticut. And at the time, Tokyo Electric was downplaying the cost, saying it would be perhaps $10 billion. And I was the first one to say that the cost was in fact going to be $250 billion or $250 billion. Now, finally, 6 years later, many think tanks in Japan have reached the same conclusion. But at the time, the Japanese government didn't want people to realize the impact of the disaster. But we put it out there at Fairwinds that this is $250 billion problem to clean up that prefecture. In the first trip, I collected 5 radioactive samples. This sample was from the roof of the publisher. I collected another sample at a children's playground, another at a Buddhist temple, another at a crack in the sidewalk. These are all in Tokyo, 140 miles away from the disaster. And then I sent it to a laboratory. And what surprised me is the answer that I got back. What the lab told us was that the dirt we collected was so radioactive that if it were in America, it would have to be classified as radioactive waste. Now, Fairwinds published that, and the Associated Press also published it. And I think the next thing that happened is illustrative. The NEI, the Nuclear Energy Institute, questioned me and the reporter and actually tried to get the reporter fired. So to AP's credit, they stood behind me for the science and the reporter for the reporting. But the pressure to publish something that goes against the orthodoxy, if you will, even with good science, is astronomical. So now I had collected 5 samples, and I said, wow, Tokyo is quite contaminated. So then, through a Freedom of Information Act, there was an NRC release of emails. One of the NRC emails said all of northern Japan is an RCA. And the press completely missed the significance of that terrifying email. In Nukespeak, RCA means radiologically contaminated area. And what that means is there's some places in a nuclear plant where you can walk in civilian clothes. But there's other places that are so contaminated you can't walk in civilian clothes, that you have to put booties on and gloves and overalls. Those are called RCAs. And here, 3 days after Fukushima Daiichi, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission knew that all of northern Japan was a radiologically contaminated area. But yet you don't see people walking around in booties and gloves and throughout all of northern Japan. That's a secret that's been kept from the Japanese people. My second trip was a university tour, and this one and all the others were indeed crowdsourced. I was there for 10 days, spoke at the University of Tokyo, and also at the Diet. The Diet is Japan's parliament. When I was at the Diet, my presentation revolved around nuclear fuel pool fires. And I had a study from a national lab where they actually heated a piece of nuclear fuel electrically and proved that indeed nuclear fuel can catch fire in a fuel pool. So I showed this picture and many others of the nuclear fuel burning in air. Well, after my presentation, TEPCO came up and made their presentation. And they said there's no risk of fire in the fuel pool because there's nothing in the fuel pool to burn. Now, the Japanese audiences are normally very attentive, but there's not a lot of emotional feedback from the group to the speaker. And I have gotten used to that. But when Tokyo Electric said there's nothing in the fuel pool to burn, 500 people started to scream. It was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. It's an example of the absolute lack of trust that the Japanese people have in both their government and in the integrity of Tokyo Electric. And the most touching thing that happened to me on my second trip was when I was in Niigata. Niigata's on the west side of Japan. Fukushima's on the east side. And I met a woman who wanted to thank me for the work that Fairwinds did. And she explained to me that she had left Fukushima Prefecture with her 2 kids and was reestablishing a life in Niigata. And her husband had told her that if she didn't return, he was going to get a divorce. This is something that's quite commonly called the Fukushima divorce now. Well, she told me with tears in her eyes that she said, okay, I am not coming back. I'm not taking the kids back. So you'll have to divorce me. But before you do, I want you to do one thing. And he said, sure, what is it? And she said, I want you to watch the Fairwind site. And he did, and he moved to Niigata to be with her. So I guess I could be a certified marriage counselor here, which was really touching personally. The third trip was a long one. It was a month, and it involved about 60 speeches and days of sample collection in Japan. A couple of the things I experienced were the amazing quantity of bags of radioactive waste. Now, each one of those black bags is a meter, about 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet, and it weighs a ton. And I saw about a couple hundred thousand bags of waste scattered throughout the entire prefecture, including in people's backyards, and they were still in their homes. In fact, there's 30 million bags of waste throughout the prefecture. Think about that. That's 30 million tons of waste throughout the prefecture. And that only includes cleanup of 5% of the prefecture. They can't clean the mountains. What they're doing is they're cleaning the streets, they're cleaning next to the streets, they're cleaning the buildings, but they're not cleaning the surroundings. That's an important thing for a little bit later. One of the most important scientific discoveries I made was on the roof of the Minamisoma Town Hall. Minamisoma was one of those communities that had been evacuated early, but the people were now told it was clean enough to come back into. The Minamisoma Town Hall had been completely decontaminated, and a nice fresh coat of green epoxy paint had been laid on the roof, and on top of that had been placed solar collectors. So that was 3 years after the disaster, and I was there 5 years after the disaster. I took samples. Guess what? There was highly radioactive dust on the roof, four stories high, of the Minamisoma Town Hall that had been previously cleaned. Well, how can that be? Of course, what's happening is if you don't clean the whole prefecture, the dirt and dust from the surrounding mountains blows back in. And it's not just the roof. What I found personally upsetting is probably too light a word. It was pain. I would see little girls riding down the street on their bicycles in the dirt on the side of the road, the dust on the side of the road, knowing that those tires were throwing up the same radioactive dirt that I had discovered on the roof of the Minamisoma Town Hall. 160,000 people evacuated their homes after the disaster, 160,000. And Japan set up these, I almost want to call them refugee camps, but they are villages for displaced people. And in this particular one, there were 60 or 70 families that came from the same town and had moved to this. I got to meet with the people in that community, and they all experienced symptoms of illness from radiation. They all experienced something that scientists don't know what causes, but there's a metallic taste in your mouth that they all experienced. And it seems to be somehow related to a physiological effect of inhaling radioactive material. Everyone experienced that. One woman had, she lost her hair. She had a bloody nose for 2 to 3 months. Her exposed skin had blotches on it. And when she went to the doctor, he said, it's stress. Another woman was evacuated very quickly from her home when she heard the sirens go off. And she ran barefoot across the lawn and got in her car and drove to the evacuation center. She was so radioactive, she was not allowed in. Her feet turned black for 3 years, and her dog died 1 week afterward. Another man, who was a fisherman, he was out fishing on the day of the disaster, and he came back in, and he said, He noticed what he said was a strange sunburn. He was sunburned through his clothes. And afterward, two or three days afterward, layers of his skin, he said two or three layers of his skin were sloughing off in sheets. That's a sign of the amount of radiation that was not measured because there weren't detectors working at the time, but to which the population was exposed. My hats are off to the women in these villages. Whenever I met with the villagers, it was the women who came forward and discussed the problems, and the men would not come out. And within Japan, there's a schism between the thoughts of the Japanese women and the thoughts of the Japanese men on nuclear power. The men trust the government and don't worry, be happy. And the women are much more questioning and concerned about future generations. Dr. Mida is one of my personal heroes. I met him on this third trip as well. Dr. Mida ran a clinic in Fukushima Prefecture and diagnosed people with radiation illness. But the government refused to pay the bills unless he changed the diagnosis to stress. And Dr. Mida refused. And he closed his clinic and left the prefecture rather than change his diagnosis. And in the process, suffered a huge financial loss as well, because none of those patients that he saw was he ever compensated for. One of my personal heroes. For the first 5 years, I was collecting samples. And this all led to a peer-reviewed paper that Dr. Marco Kaltofen and I have published. Dr. Kaltofen is at Worcester Polytechnic in Massachusetts. And the journal is called STOTEN. It's called Science of the Total Environment. What we discovered, based on all this data that we've collected, is this. We have the largest database of dirt and dust samples in the world. We had about 200 samples of dirt from America and Canada, and about the same number of samples from dirt in Japan. Well, the median of data is you stack all the data out in a row and from the lowest to the highest. And the median radiation in America is about 2 becquerels per kilogram. In a kilogram of dirt, there's 2 disintegrations every second. That's the median in America, largely from bomb testing. So 2 is the number for America. In Japan, the median is 3,000. Now, that's a concern enough, but the bigger concern is the rest of the data. The mean, which is just the average, is 9 times higher than the median. And 5% of the data is 10,000 times higher than the median. Now, what does that mean? It's my geek moment here. That means that the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency's dose model for the Japanese is wrong. They're assuming sort of a uniform distribution of radiation in what's being inhaled or what's being imbibed. But what we discovered is it's not uniform. And there's a significant 5+% of the particles that these people are inhaling are much larger than the IAEA allows. So the exposure to those individuals over 10 or 15 or 20 years. Because remember, these particles are so small, they don't leave your lungs. They don't leave your liver. They will cause a significant increase in cancers over the years that the IAEA and the Japanese government are refusing to acknowledge. Okay, trip number 4. This stadium is going to be used for the Olympic baseball games. It's in the middle of Fukushima Prefecture. The choice of using this stadium as opposed to another stadium anywhere else in Japan is obviously to show the world that it's over. The disaster's over, you can come back in and you can play ball. A gross public relations ploy, risking athletes and the people who observe the events. This is a scanning electron microscope. It costs about $3 million. This was in a lab that had just been opened by the Japanese Atomic Energy Agency. And they showed Dr. Kaltofen and I their entire lab. And Dr. Kaltofen asked a great question. He said, we've got our data out there, and you know, have you read our report, which they hadn't. And he said, well, where is your data? This lab is as good as the work we're doing at Worcester Poly. And the director, who's over there on the left, said, oh, we take great data. We're just not publishing it. So they're not letting scientists know. They're not letting doctors know. And they're certainly not letting the professional literature know what we have found. They can do quality work and probably are doing quality work. They're just refusing to publish it. Well, to kind of summarize my experiences in Japan, I have become sort of a friend to Naoto Kan. Naoto Kan was the Prime Minister of Japan before Abe, and he was the person who was in charge on the during the period of that the disaster began. Naoto Kan said to me, our existence as a sovereign nation was at stake. And I talked to him about the decision to evacuate Tokyo or not. And I said, you know, given the information he had, I think he made the right decision. And he said to me, he said, Arnie, the information I received, and this is from METI, the regulator, and from Tokyo Electric, said the information I received was neither accurate nor timely. Now, how can you regulate when your staff and Tokyo Electric are telling you lies, and when they tell you it, it's already old news? In addition, of course, if you read Gorbachev's memoirs, he credits the collapse of the Soviet Union, not the perestroika. He said, we didn't fail because of perestroika. We failed because of Chernobyl. So nuclear is a technology that can destroy the fabric of a country overnight. And there's nothing like that on the planet. You know, if a coal plant blows up, it blows up. But when a nuclear plant blows up, it destroys the fabric of a country overnight. So my hats are off to the women of Japan for stepping up and taking the lead politically on this environmental issue. The numbers are about 80% of the women want nuclear closed down, and slightly less than half of the men want nuclear closed down. The net effect is 60 to 70% of the total population wants nuclear closed down, and yet the Abe administration continues to start up these plants that have been deferred. And the reason for that is the pressure from the banks who want their money back. Radiation knows no borders. Thank you.
That was Arnie Gundersen of Fairwinds Energy Education, recorded by Dale Lehman in Chicago on December 2nd, 2017. Gundersen had been invited by the Nuclear Energy Information Service to provide balance to the positive descriptions of nuclear weapons and nuclear power given on the 75th anniversary celebration of the first nuclear chain reaction that took place at the University of Chicago. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelerden. Thank you for listening.